It's a bit like a John Cage performance right before the talk. He has this famous performance called 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And basically the performance is the sounds that are happening in the audience during that time. So the rustles and the coughs and maybe the distant sirens, which we don't get too many of here, but that was the symphony. We get John Cage symphonies every day here. Aren't we lucky? What is mindfulness? Do you know yet? I hope not. I think that we can keep discovering what mindfulness is. I know that I keep discovering it. A number of years ago, not that even that many, maybe 5 years ago, I was on retreat in Burma with my teacher, and I went in to her at one point and I said, I feel like I'm just discovering what mindfulness is. And she's like, good, that means that you're paying attention. So we talked about it a little bit the other day in my first talk as a kind of soft readiness, perhaps a kind-hearted attention to what's happening in the moment. And there's another aspect of mindfulness that I'm going to emphasize a bit tonight. And this is mindfulness as a kind of, you could, sometimes it's the words used are a penetrating awareness, or an awareness that sinks into the object, not superficial, but an awareness that connects to the truth of things. So this mindfulness helps us connect to reality, to what is truly there, you could say, rather than living in our wishes and dreams and delusions and distortions of the mind, which is how we usually live. We usually live in the way that we want things to be. And mindfulness helps us connect to the way things really are. And often this is described as insight into the three characteristics, the universal truths of life that we've mentioned a number of times now, anicca, dukkha, and anatta, impermanence, unreliability, unsatisfactoriness, and corelessness or not-self. And so you'll notice in our talks that we repeat ourselves quite a bit, or we talk about the same thing over and over again, and sometimes us Western yogis are like, okay, come on, let's move on to the next thing. When I've practiced in Burma, usually a talk is, the first three quarters of the talk is a repetition of the talk before, and then the last quarter is something new. And the idea is that the repetition helps us to really learn and to remember and to retain. So we'll talk about these universal characteristics repeatedly. So that's the kind of insight that we're most pointing towards, is the insight into the nature of reality or the way things are or how life is. And we may have other insights. We may have psychological insights or personal insights, and these can be useful. They also are part of practice, definitely come up. But Vipassana is pointing towards the insights related to the way things are, the way the world is. And as we said, this comes not through our cognitive mind figuring things out, but through a moment-by-moment connection with experience. It's more intuitive. Greg used that word the other night, I think. Sometimes I've seen in Spanish, Vipassana translated as meditación intuitiva, intuitive meditation. So it's not so conceptual, some kinds of meditation are, but this kind isn't so conceptual, not so contemplative, but more as living the truth with awareness. So we're waking up out of our dream worlds over and over, connecting over and over with now, here, experience arising in the present moment, arising and passing away. So tonight I'd like to talk more, primarily more, about Vedana, which was introduced yesterday in the instructions by Winnie. So we already have spoken quite a bit of the first foundation of mindfulness, the mindfulness of body. We've talked about exploring the different postures, about the elemental nature of the body through sensations, about breath meditation, about full comprehension, which is this mindfulness of all of our activities, all of our movements during the day. And so we've been discussing the establishment of mindfulness through the body as our foundation. And so now in this talk, I'm going to move into the second foundation of mindfulness, and if I have time, I'll touch on the last two also and complete our duty, what we wrote in the description. But we'll get to it. So we're moving into the second foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of feeling tone or Vedana. Greg said this is a very important part of practice. We just had a little chat before I came out to give the talk. And he said, Greg Scharf, the illustrious and highly esteemed historian and political scientist, Greg Scharf said that all wars start because of Vedana. That I'm paraphrasing him just to get him off the hook here. That wars start because people can't tolerate unpleasant Vedana. So they start a war. And I added that maybe they want something, there's pleasant Vedana, so they start a war. And we all agreed in the staff dining room before I came out that wars could be prevented if we could all skillfully relate to Vedana. So Vedana, as you know, is the first impression of sense contact, whether we experience it as pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, which we usually state as neutral. But in the text, it's usually neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Might be varying degrees of pleasant, might be varying degrees of unpleasant, but those are your three choices. So according to Buddhist psychology, a moment of experience is called a moment of sense contact. And sense contact is the coming together of three things: the sense object, the sense door, and the sense consciousness. So for example, a moment of hearing is the coming together of sound waves, that's the sense object, the ear, that's the sense door, and hearing consciousness. And if one of those were absent, we wouldn't have a moment of experience, we wouldn't have a moment of hearing. Already, this is kind of fascinating because what we see is that there isn't some independent existence of us doing the hearing, but rather that it arises. It arises as a coming together of causes and conditions. A moment of life arises with this coming together of causes and conditions, the sense object, sense door, and the sense consciousness. So continuing on with Buddhist psychology, each one of these moments of sense contact has this affective quality, this feeling tone. It arises at the same time as the moment of contact. So this affective quality is basically the first impression of our being, of whether an experience lands as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Now, in a moment, in a second in Buddhist psychology, I believe there are 7,000 mind moments in a second. And so each one of those mind moments has a feeling tone. So things are moving pretty quick here. 7,000 in a second. So what we see is that this feeling tone is also dependent on causes and conditions. As Winnie said yesterday, it's not inherent in the object. Greg sometimes says, the object is innocent. It rather comes together because of causes and conditions. This became very obvious to me once this last summer. So one of my favorite sounds in the world is the song of the wood thrush. I don't know if you guys know what it sounds like, but it's that bird that sings in the woods. You don't see them very much because thrushes are secretive. But it's kind of like a flute, and it's ethereal. Beautiful sound. Anyway, I was pretty sure I could never get too much of wood thrushes. But one day last summer, there were like 4 wood thrushes in our yard, and are near our yard, and they weren't right in the yard because they're wood birds, but near our yard, and they sang all day long. They must have been having a wood thrush convention or something, I don't know, because they don't usually do this, but they sang, they just kept singing and singing and singing, and finally at 4 o'clock, around 4 o'clock, I turn to my partner and I say, I do believe I'm experiencing the wood thrush song as unpleasant. I was so surprised. The wood thrushes were innocent. It was just the way that the causes and conditions came together after a whole day of hearing their song. So perhaps you can remember this the next time somebody coughs in the hall. They're innocent. It's just that the sound lands on us, perhaps unpleasant in the moment, or perhaps for some people it's pleasant. It wakes us up, brings us back. I remember one time I had a group of yogis, and there was a yogi who snored a lot in the hall, so this came up as a topic of conversation, the snoring yogi. And some people were like, you know, it's really driving me crazy, I don't like it. And then this one pipes up, she goes, I love it, it reminds me of my grandfather. It's not the snoring or the snorer, innocent. It's just how Vedana expresses itself has to do with all these causes of and conditions due to like our conditioning, like her grandfather, memories of her grandfather. And, you know, the wood thrushes was how long I'd been listening to the song. And sometimes it has to do with how our nervous system is that day. So just very, very many kind of conditions come together. So I think most of you know by now our usual conditioning or our usual response to Vedana if we haven't trained our minds and if mindfulness isn't strong. I want to read a little story from the time of the Buddha. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. In the time of the Buddha, there was a wealthy merchant named Visakha living in the ancient city of Rajagaha. Both he and his wife had attained the third stage of enlightenment called non-returner. Later, his wife was ordained as a nun Dhammadina, and she soon finished the spiritual journey becoming an arahant. So basically, she beat him. And I wonder if they kind of had a competition going. So at one point, her husband goes to her, I guess he's not her husband anymore, she's a nun, her ex-husband. Visakha goes to the nun Dhammadina with a series of questions, so he goes to her for teachings, which I find touching. And Visakha asks, what habitual tendencies underlie pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings? And she responds, as we might expect, desire or lust is the conditioned tendency underlying pleasant feeling. Aversion is the conditioned tendency underlying unpleasant feeling. And delusion is the conditioned tendency underlying neutral feeling. And it goes on to ask some other questions, but that's basically our conditioning, right? I remember when I used to study the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, I sometimes had this thought like, why does Vedana, it's just a little thing, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, not such a big deal. Why does it get one whole foundation out of four? That seemed like such a big chunk for such a little thing. But really what we start to see when we're exploring for ourselves is we start to see that Vedana is where the whole chain of suffering starts. It's the beginning of dukkha, that unconscious or unmindful reaction to feeling tone. I like how Christina Feldman describes it in a handout that she has. The basic feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral regarding any experience is not a problem in itself. That's good to remember. It is simply how it is. It is rather like a stage set for a theater production. The feeling tone we have is analogous to the fundamental set before the show starts. What happens, however, is that we are overtaken by underlying tendencies. If we have a pleasant experience, we of course want to keep it, we want more of it, and suddenly we're off. The curtain is raised and the play has begun. We lose sight of the vital truth that all things change. We undermine our capacity to find balance, to be with the full spectrum of Vedana in our life. So Vedana is what starts the whole production. So we need to understand Vedana very deeply in our spiritual search here, in our journey to freedom. Understand it deeply and to see that there are alternatives to our usual conditioning, the conditioning that leads to suffering, to grasping, aversion, and delusion. We start to see that it's very stressful to live in continual reaction to feeling tone. That's how we generally live. We're kind of like ping pongs being whipped all around by feeling tone, the changing feeling tone and our reaction to them this way, that way. The kind of the basic restlessness that we experience is due to this continual, either gross or subtle, reactivity to feeling tone. It's stressful. And sometimes people wonder like, well, why can't I just figure this out in a 3-month retreat? This is hundreds of thousands of years of evolution that we're looking at here. So you might understand why it's kind of tenacious. It's been deeply ingrained conditioning. So when we bring in mindfulness, what happens then? So we have these habitual conditioning or habitual conditioning without mindfulness. What happens when we bring in mindfulness? When we bring in mindfulness, there's some possibility of breaking the chain of conditioning, the automatic chain of conditioning. Just pleasant, just unpleasant. Don't have to take the next step into grasping or aversion. Just to have a glimpse of this is very freeing. It's an evolutionary leap. So at first, when we're exploring Vedana, those of you who've been exploring it, you probably notice that the reactivity seems, married to the Vedana. So unpleasant and aversion, they just seem like they come together, like there's no separation. pleasant and grasping, they seem like they come together, that there's no separation. We start to explore with mindfulness whether this actually has to be true. One of my more transformative moments in meditation happened in this hall. I was sitting right back there, and it was a day when they were mowing the lawn. You don't have to worry about that in November, fortunately. But I was having very nice, peaceful, concentrated sitting. I was very happy with my sitting. And then they started mowing the lawn. And I got very aversive. I didn't like it at all. I started a whole drama in my mind. It was like, wow, why can't they mow the lawn like during the walking periods? Don't they have any respect? And like, I was having a great practice, and now look what they did to it. And you know, the kind of thoughts we have as yogis. And then I was like, wait a moment, let's take this apart. Like, what's happening here? When I realized there was a sound, it was experienced as unpleasant, and then there was all this drama in my mind. And in that moment, this thought arose, what if it just stops with unpleasant? And it did. It was like, oh, it's just unpleasant. All this drama and aversion and everything because it's unpleasant. And in that moment, it was like, wow, that's like, not necessary, it's overreacting. It's not necessary. And I saw that there can be a gap between aversion, I mean, between unpleasant vedana and aversion. And it was very freeing to see that. So it's back to, we let our own experience teach us. And anything can be a teacher, a lawnmower can be a teacher. Another time I had, I got very interested in exploring especially pleasant vedana. One time when I was practicing in Burma again, and for a number of years I practiced in Burma. So at the retreat center in Burma, or at the monastery in Burma, every morning they have la pecho, sweet tea, Burmese sweet tea. It's very, very good. They make it with sweetened condensed milk, and they froth it all up, and it's really good. So I start looking forward to sweet tea about 6 months before I go to Burma. And it's one of, you know, those things where, like, you're having a bad yogi day, and you have the thought, okay, this is coming up, I can make it. So it'd be like bad yogi day in Burma, be like, yeah, but tomorrow morning there's la paella cho. I'm going to make it, you know. Just that's how important la paella cho is to me. So I would really look forward to it. So one year I get there and go down to breakfast the first morning. I'm looking forward to my sweet tea. And I kind of drop in quick, usually in retreat, but especially in Burma, it's like this monastery has been a monastery for like 1,000 years, so there's just a lot of energy, right? So our people have been meditating there for 1,000 years. It's not necessarily a monastery. They started out with caves in the side of the river, in the riverbank. Anyway, so go down to breakfast. So I'm drinking my first cup of sweet tea, and I'm noticing pleasant vedana, right? Pleasant. And then what I notice is that it doesn't last. And so what it is, I notice pleasant, it feels like be pleasant ending, pleasant ending, pleasant ending. That was my experience, so like pleasant ending, pleasant ending, pleasant ending. And I was so disappointed. I cried all the way through breakfast. I didn't sob, it was just tears, but tears running down my cheeks because it was clear that the pleasantness wasn't going to do it. It was clear that it ended, that it was unreliable. And obviously there was some attachment happening. stringing together pleasantness is not going to do it. So then it was so interesting to me to just watch this. And so every morning I would go down to tea and just notice Vedana and what happened, usually pleasant Vedana. I went through a lot of different things with my tea. I remember one time I got angry at the tea. I was like, you're supposed to, you know, do it, and you're not doing it. But a lot of disappointment. And then one morning, I went for my tea. Sip of tea, pleasant, ending, peace. Pleasant ending, peace, pleasant ending, peace. There was just peace. And interestingly, the pleasantness of the tea was no longer actually the primary experience. It was the pleasantness of peace. I had, I had learned to connect with reality as it is, rather than fighting reality. So you could say that our reactions to pleasant of grasping and our reactions of aversion to unpleasantness is our arguments with reality. And what we learn is how to cooperate with reality. And so this peace, this pleasantness of peace, was superior to the pleasantness of the tea. Some people are like, are we going to lose our ability to enjoy pleasantness? Not necessarily, but the pleasantness of peace, of an unagitated mind, an agitated heart, a heart at rest, far superior. So some of you 3-monthers, I think, I sense, just the first whispers of a little bit of weariness, getting a little bit tired. Maybe the energy's dropping a little bit. And I found myself wondering today if that partly might be due to disappointment. That our projects didn't deliver what we have come here for. Our projects haven't delivered yet, and it's starting to look like they might not. You could hope until halfway through, right? But but now we're on week 7.5, you know, and it's starting, it's not looking good. And these projects, they have something to do with how can I get some everlasting pleasantness? And how can I get rid of something unpleasant? That they probably fall into those categories. Charlotte Joko Beck, one of my favorite Zen teachers, says, practice has to be a process of endless disappointment. We have to see that everything we demand and even get eventually disappoints us. This gut discovery is our teacher. Trungpa Rinpoche says, disappointment is a good sign of basic intelligence. It cannot be compared to anything else. It is so sharp, precise, obvious, and direct. If we can open, then we suddenly begin to see that our expectations are irrelevant compared to the reality of the situation we are facing. So this disappointment has wisdom jewels to mine, because what it tells us is that we're looking in the wrong place for our happiness. If we're looking to somehow increase pleasantness and decrease unpleasantness as our refuge, as what's going to save us, that we're looking in the wrong place. Adyashanti says, the role of spiritual practice is basically to exhaust the seeker. If the practice does what it's supposed to do, it exhausts our energy for seeking, and then reality has a chance to present itself. What if you gave up your projects? What if you let the disappointment or the weariness point you in that direction? Rumi said, make the road home, home. Henry Miller said in The Tropic of Cancer, somehow the realization that nothing was to be hoped for had a salutary effect upon me. For weeks and months, for years, in fact all my life, I had been looking forward to something happening, some extrinsic event that would alter my life. And now suddenly, inspired by the absolute hopelessness of everything, I felt relieved, as if a great burden had been lifted from my shoulders. There's relief in letting go of our projects and the hope that we will somehow get it together in a way, in the future sometime, not now, but in the future that we'll get it together. Pema Chodron talks about the first time she met her teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche. I love this sentence, but yogis don't always respond like I do. Let's see what you guys think. He told everyone present that if they'd come to get their act together, they should just forget it because they never would. I think that's great. It's kind of back to the hopelessness of Henry Miller. When we get tired of seeking the perfect kind of circumstances or the perfect something or the something that's always in the future that is going to resolve our restlessness, when we let go of that, then there's hope that we can rest right here and now, where there is the possibility for freedom. It's like we can settle. Instead of going like that, we can settle here and now. I'm just trying to decide if I want to tell you a story, if I have time for it. I think I will tell you this story. So on my first long retreat here, I stayed for 5 months, and I stayed the 3 months, and I stayed longer, stayed 5 months. And at some point, I think it was around the fourth month, I started to think fairly incessantly, it felt then like it was like that, about what was going to make me happy. So that was the theme. And so I kept coming up with these pictures or these scenarios of what was going to do it, how I was going to arrange my life so that I was going to be happy forever. And so I tried out different scenarios. I'm kind of an introvert, so the first one was I was going to get this nice little cabin in the mountains, right, and kind of meditate a lot, and like that would do it. And then my mind was like, no, that's not going to do it, because then I get lonely, right? So then I'm like, well, I'll join some kind of spiritual community of like-minded people, and that would really be nice. I was in my 20s, so I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life also. It was a good time for that. And then I was like, no, but if I live in a community, oh, people will drive me crazy. And then I was like, well, maybe I'll have kids and raise a family. And then I was like, oh, too much responsibility. And this went on for a month. Just that sense of like, what's going to do it? What's going to make me happy? And trying to figure out like how I could line things up so that basically they'd be pleasant, right? Not unpleasant. And nothing was working, nothing was working. And there was so much fear, so much restlessness and fear. I was doing that Mahasi noting that Brian discussed this morning, and I was doing it very seriously, where you note like every 2 or 3 seconds. And when I would wake up in the morning, the first note would be fear. Just fear. And then finally, after I was exhausted, I went in one day to my teacher and I said, it looks like there's nothing out there that's going to permanently do it. And she said, yep. And I said, so I guess the place to look is right here, right now. Like that's the only place that I'm going to find happiness, peace. She said, yep. And in that afternoon, the fear went away. And it was replaced by a lot of peace. And I think it was because I started to look in a realistic place for happiness rather than that it's going to be out there in some kind of conditions that I can create, which doesn't work. Conditions change. Now, for you youngsters out there, that doesn't mean that you don't try to create a good life for yourselves. You do, okay? but we don't take circumstances as our refuge. We take our capacity, basically, to be with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral as our refuge, or our capacity to be with change, because change is totally in there, totally part of the equation. In the Satipatthana Sutta, we're also supposed to pay attention to change, to the arising and passing away of things. There's that first of the three characteristics. In this way, reading from the sutra, in this way they contemplate feelings as feelings internally, oops, I'm going to get to that later. They abide contemplating feelings in their arising factors, or they abide contemplating in feelings their vanishing factors, or they abide contemplating feelings both their arising and vanishing factors. So basically, the arising and passing away of feelings, feeling tone. This, they call it feelings here, but it's that feeling tone. So the arising and passing away. And with all of the foundations, we're instructed in the same way to notice the arising factors, the vanishing factors, and both the arising and vanishing factors, which is basically a way of saying, notice the arising, notice the ending, notice the arising and the ending. Notice change. One time, Suzuki Roshi, the famous Zen master teacher, somebody said to him, you know, you talk so much about Buddhism, this and that, and I get so confused. I don't always understand what you're saying. Can you, like, just simplify it for me? And Suzuki Roshi said, everything changes. There's the Dharma. So why do we care so much about everything changing? Why does that matter? A number of years ago, I was a Buddhist advisor at a college in our area. And one time I was talking about change with the young women, and I said it's a women's college. So I said, why do we, you know, what's the big deal? Everything changes, right? Why do we keep putting so much emphasis on this? And one of the young women said, because that's the way things are, and if you have issues with that, you have to deal with them. we all have issues with change. And what we're doing here is we're dealing with that. We're dealing with our issues with change. Working out our issues with change. And so what we start to see, because Vedana is always changing, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, always changing, we start to see that stress comes from our reactivity, right, to the grasping, the aversion, and the kind of spacing out too. I'll get into that a little bit more, the spacing out, the delusion. As I said, it's our arguments with reality, and we start to see that we're going to lose and that it's very stressful to live that way. And we start to consider another way of living, which is more, you could say, the ability to flow or to accommodate to the truth of the way things are, to increase our tolerance for all Vedana, for pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And it's not passive. We still respond in the way that is most useful, most skillful, but we're not arguing with reality all the time. We give up being micromanagers of the universe. That's basically what we're doing all the time. We're micromanaging the universe, or we're micromanaging life as it manifests right here in this heart, body, mind. Micromanaging is stressful. When we see that, we start to consider that there might be alternatives to how to live. Alternatives that are peaceful and at restful. So let's get a little bit more specific about how we would practice with Vedana. As Winnie said yesterday, and I agree, don't try to do it all the time. Sometimes when the mind is very quiet, sometimes people will have the instruction to just be aware of Vedana, but it can be subtle, and if you try to do it all the time, you're probably going to drive yourself crazy, or you're going to just spend all your time thinking, what's the Vedana of this? What's the Vedana of that? And then lose kind of that moment-to-moment connection. I find it most helpful to practice with Vedana when there's some feeling of being stuck. So, for example, there's a pleasant experience. You have a pleasant experience. We call it a pleasant experience. There's an experience that's landing as pleasant in this moment as the longhand. We'll just call it a pleasant experience, but that makes it sound like something's to blame. but it's an experience that's landing as pleasant. So we could choose a pleasant experience, and then we can do that. We can be with that mindfully, kind of like the tea in Burma. So what we might notice is, how does the mind and heart respond to that pleasantness? So we might notice a kind of sense of perhaps slight tension or contraction or stress. Or sometimes attachment to pleasantness manifests as exuberance, exhilaration, a kind of agitation. So we notice if that's there. And then we turn and look at that. What happens when we notice the attachment to the pleasantness? It's interesting because if we pay attention to attachment to pleasantness, what we start to see is that the attachment actually disconnects us from the experience. We actually lose some of the pleasantness through the attachment, because the attachment itself is unpleasant. So we don't tend to want to turn towards it so much. We'd rather just focus on the pleasant object, right? But we turn and notice if there's any contraction, attachment. What happens when we notice that? If there isn't grasping or it ends, what's it like to be with just pleasantness? So we have three things we can move between. We have the sense experience. We have the pleasantness, the vedana, and then we have the response or reactivity. So either the grasping, or if there's no grasping, equanimity, the peace of mind, heart. Like, let's say you're watching the sunset, a big yogi experience, at least for some yogis. So you're watching the sunset. It's beautiful, right? There's beautiful colors. And then we can notice that sometimes we're noticing, seeing, right? Pleasant. And then there's this kind of tension that comes in. Like, I think I want to get a little bit more out of this. How can I grok it just a little bit more? Or how can I really just milk it a little bit more? You guys know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah, so that's attachment. That's pleasantness leading to attachment. That's another way it might manifest. It's like, how can I more fully embrace this experience? Wanting pleasantness. So we can notice seeing the colors, pleasantness, and the response. And we can move through those. Just seeing where there's, you could say, flexibility, where there's a chance for freedom, not the usual habitual conditioning. Same with an unpleasant experience. Do most of you have an unpleasant experience happening right now, like physically? I was thinking we could try it together. Let's try it. And if you don't have any, if your body's not in pain at all, well, lucky you. you can just listen to the instructions. But just close your eyes for a minute. You don't have to get all well seated. But is there some place in your body that there's some kind of pain or unpleasant experience arising, or experiences landing unpleasant? So you can notice the sensations. And then you can notice what's the relationship. Is there any kind of rejection, aversion, pushing away, hating, wanting to fix? Or is there equanimity and ability to be with that? If there is any kind of rejection, exile, aversion, put your attention on the unpleasantness. Notice the unpleasantness of the sensations. Then notice what your relationship to the sensations are. Is there still aversion, perhaps? Has that changed? You can go back to the original sensations if you want. Curious what those are. So you can move between the sensations, the reactivity, if it's present. It might not be, but if it is, and the unpleasantness. Seeing for yourself how the conditioning happens and where there might be possibility, sometimes just landing on the unpleasantness and knowing it's just unpleasant can make room for the mind and heart to free themselves, to be freer in relationship. Sometimes just feeling the sensations that can happen. And sometimes You just hate the sensations. Sometimes it doesn't change, right? You just notice that experience of not liking or aversion to the sensations, and then move away at a certain point back to your anchor. You can open your eyes again if you want, keep them closed. End of experiment is what I'm saying. So what we're doing is we're increasing our tolerance for unpleasantness. And as we increase our tolerance for unpleasantness, the mind and heart become freer. We don't always have to be adjusting to try to avoid unpleasantness so we can rest. Now, of course, if there's some unpleasant sensation, like in your back, for example, and it's getting worse and worse every day, then you respond, you do something. I just want to make that clear. But anything can teach us. Any pain in the body is a great teacher. I also want to say that sometimes there's a skillful way of using pleasantness, pleasant vedana. So if there's a lot of suffering in your practice, if you're getting worn out, if there's lots of intense emotion, for example, sometimes we'll instruct you to seek out pleasantness in order to relax the heart and the mind and soothe the nervous system. So it can be a skillful balancer in your practice. Now, I know the options around here aren't stellar, but you can find some pleasantness. I mean, even on a cold day, just a nice cup of ginger tea with lots of honey in it, that's pretty pleasant. Or today, right, like the warm, the soft warmth of the wind on the cheek, quite pleasant. Or the November, if the sun comes out, I'm assuming it will at some point, but I'm beginning to worry about that. maybe it went out 8.5 minutes ago. And but the sun through the trees in November is beautiful. The woods are so open, and the tree branches can be so illuminated. So there's beauty in nature. We can appreciate the pleasantness and allow it to soothe our nervous system. Or a cup of tea, let's see what else. Looking at pumpkins. The staff put so much love into these pumpkins for you. It's really their love. I remember my first 3-month retreat coming in here. I had no idea that this was a tradition, and I cried and cried. Because I felt that love. It was beautiful. So finding pleasantness can be helpful. So let's talk a little bit about neutral feeling tone. Some people say that they experience a lot of neutral, and some people say like nothing is neutral. So either way you lean, completely normal. For me, neutral is not that often. Like I'm by nature an aversive type, so I tend to head that direction. The pleasant, back to the pleasant. It's good for aversive types to get some pleasantness to balance the aversion in the mind, the hardness in the mind. And in the commentaries, that's actually suggested. Like they talk about the ideal dwelling place for different personality types, different types. So those who have a lot of aversion, a lot of anger, hatred, fear, ill will, annoyance, all the full spectrum, they're instructed to have a beautiful place to meditate. Their hut is supposed to be clean, well painted. Their bed's supposed to have sheets of fine silk. Their food is supposed to be magnificently spiced. Their servants are supposed to be good looking. This is what it says in the commentaries. But the whole idea is to soothe, 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 that kind of aversive. Now, you types who are more kind of greedy, the wanting types, I'm sorry. You're supposed to have a bug infested. Now, you should read it, the bug infested cottage with like trash strewn around and bats, you know, pooping on you and ugly servants and horrible plain food. And you go. And the confused types, you get the same as the aversive types. You get a nice, nice hut. Anyway, that was an aside. Back to neutral. So what about neutral feeling tone? Our tendency with neutral feeling tone is to not pay attention, to just space out. Like, you know, our thought is like, you know, where's the action here? Nothing happening, I'm out of here. Right? And evolutionarily, it was like preserved our energy for things that might actually be important for our survival. Neutral things usually weren't important for our survival. And so when we space out, it said that delusion then kind of continues unabated. Our usual delusion about the way things are. So that's the habitual tendency towards delusion with neutral feeling tone. So what we try to see is, can we be with neutral? Our anchor should be neutral, maybe slightly pleasant. Can we be interested? Can we stay connected with what's neutral? You might have to risk being bored. So we can notice if we're spacing out and our anchor's fairly neutral, we can notice, oh, the sensations of breathing, neutral. Noticing that they're neutral, does that help us connect more? Check it out and see for yourself. Neutral feeling tone is actually a really interesting place to explore, because for some of us, it can give us our first taste of peace. Because with neutral, there's nothing to grasp at or to push away, because it's neutral. And so we can develop a taste for neutral. You can say that when we meditate, we develop a taste for, we don't need as much stimulation. We develop a taste for simplicity. And we see the rest and the peace that's in that. Well, I've used up our hour, and I didn't get to anywhere near the third and fourth. But we have talked a lot about the third foundation, so you are not being shortchanged there. And the fourth foundation, as I mentioned in some scholarship, it's basically the hindrances and the factors of enlightenment. So we had a talk on the hindrances, and we're going to get a talk on the factors of awakening. So that will help cover that. From the Buddha. When a bhikkhu has heard that nothing is worth adhering to, they directly know everything, whatever feeling they feel, whether pleasant or painful, or neither unpleasant nor pleasant, they abide contemplating impermanence in these feelings. Contemplating thus, they do not cling to anything in this world. When they do not cling, they are not agitated. When they are not agitated, they personally attain nibbana. So mindfulness of Vedana can take us all the way. That will do it for tonight. Let's sit for a couple minutes. Whatever feeling they feel, whether pleasant or painful, or neither unpleasant nor pleasant, they abide contemplating impermanence in these feelings. Contemplating thus, they do not cling to anything in this world. When they do not cling, they are not agitated. When they are not agitated, they personally attain nibbana.